session number 10597.
Reel 3.
Mr. Masters, reel 3. You were saying it was about 20,000.
Yes, which that was high altitude for us. Now, normally these jet streams you don't experience at low levels, although I have come across one of about 125 knots at 12,000 feet, but that was after the war. But I say, generally speaking, these jet streams were at very high altitude.
Carry on.
No, I'll just say that was all I wanted to say, that the jet streams are normally at high altitude.
You were saying that the German night fighters laid out lights.
Yes.
Can you tell me why?
Well, we understand that on this particular raid, which we discovered afterwards, that the night fighters, the German night fighters, were laying flares so to allow other fighters to come in and follow the track of the bombers. It was an indication as where the bombers were going. Now we understand that not all of these lights were laid by German night fighters. Some of them were laid by British night fighters, because they got in with their flares as well. And what they did is they then sort of drew big circles in the sky with their lights and crisscross lines, which thoroughly confused everybody. It was only meant to confuse the German night fighters, but that's what it did. So the night fighters then had no idea of where the bombers were coming in.
Before you joined the Pathfinders, what was the attitude of you and your brother air crew towards the work that the Pathfinders were doing?
Very grateful to them, because we didn't have such sophisticated equipment as the Pathfinders had at that time, because we didn't carry H2S and they did. And it was very nice to know that the target was being marked for us. We didn't have to look for it ourselves. I don't know how we could have really found it under cloud, perhaps at night after flying for 4 hours. You had to be accurate. And this, I think, was where the problem arose from some of the earlier air crew, that they didn't have the navigation aids to get precisely to where they should be.
So there wasn't any jealousy or rivalry with the Pathfinders?
Not that I know, no. No. This was something else that Pathfinders would do. They would, with the extra equipment that was carried, they were able to measure winds fairly accurately all the way into the target. And all the time they were going there, the winds would be transmitted back to base. A general wind would be calculated. This would be retransmitted to the bomber crews, who would then use that wind for a given period, so that if anybody was wrong, they were all wrong together. The idea was to keep the stream close together. And that helped no end. See, because after, if we were heading east, once the G packed up, we might be flying for quite some time before we had any accurate means of checking the wind. What we would do is we'd take a G fix every 6 minutes and keep recalculating the wind, compare it with the forecast wind, and then apply a correction to the forecast wind. So from then on, once we got out of the G range, we applied this correction to the met wind that we'd been given, until we got the Pathfinder winds, as I said, which kept us all together.
Which did you fear most, the German night fighters or the FLAC?
That's rather a difficult question, because the FLAC you could do nothing about. The fighters, could be persistent. But even so, I mean, this was something which they could maneuver a fighter, well, they couldn't maneuver the flak, if you understand what I'm saying. But I felt safer in a bomber at night than I would have been, I think, as a night fighter pilot. Because providing you're awake and your gunners were alert and we did the right thing, it was almost impossible for a night fighter to hit us. And we found in general that if a night fighter made an attack and the aircraft got out of his way or fired back, he wouldn't come back again. He'd go looking for somebody else who wasn't aware of what was going on. You've probably heard of the corkscrew technique, have you?
No.
Well, what would happen is that the gunners would pick up a fighter coming in, and normally the fighter would sit up, say, on a high quarter. The idea then, they would adjust their speed to the bomber's speed so they'd know what they were going to fire at. Then they would make their attack. They'd increase their speed. They'd turn towards the aircraft, start diving, and then we will say they're coming in from the starboard quarter. They would go into a starboard bank so that they couldn't see the bomber. The bomber was now underneath their belly, and they would fire at where the bomber was going to be. So the gunners would wait until the fighter dropped his wing, ready to turn in to start firing. We would then turn into the bomber and drop.
Turn into the fighter,
and then when I say we wouldn't dive, we would drop out of the sky maybe 300 or 400 feet. Then what happened is the fighter would suddenly see the bomber right across his bows, and he would have to either pull through and dive for the ground or go straight up. And in the meantime, we had rolled the other way and started to climb, and the scheme was that the fighter would finish up at 500 feet or something like that, point blank range, where the gunners could fire at him, providing the gunners were smart enough, you know, providing the gunners did exactly as they were trained to do and exactly as the pilot did exactly as the gunners told him to. We had a CO come from a fighter unit, and he said, "I've heard about these corkscrew techniques." He said, "They're absolute rubbish." So he said, "I'll prove it to you. You go up in the Lancaster." He said, "I'll come up with the camera guns and the Spitfire, and I'll make some attacks on you." And I suppose he was making attacks for, 15, 20 minutes. And eventually he called us up and he said, "Right, back to base." He said, "I couldn't touch you." And he knew, you know, he could see us, but he couldn't actually touch us. Then, post-war, I was talking to a day fighter pilot, and he said he had an American colleague with him. They're flying along, and suddenly they saw an RAF Lancaster lower down. So they said, "Well, let's make an attack on him, shall we, just for fun?" Which they did. And he said, and suddenly the bomber turned straight into us and frightened us to death, and we had to dive for the ground to stop hitting him. So he was probably a wartime bomber pilot, you know, which had used the technique, because he didn't know what these two were going to do. They said, "Well, wish they'd told us." But post-war, of course, we weren't normally allowed to do that sort of thing because it was too dangerous.
Which member of the crew, of the bomber crew, do you think had the worst job?
I would think the gunners. They were cold. It was dangerous. And they were lonely. All they could do was really sit and search and search and search. They didn't dare look away from the sky. They couldn't even look at the target in case they lost their night vision.
Some people make comparisons between the job which a bomber crew had to carry out and the job which, say, somebody in the army would have to do, an infantryman. What do you feel about the comparison between the two jobs?
I know what your other son have been doing. Flying.
And yet somebody like Bennett says that a tour of 30 operations was like fighting three major battles, like the Battle of the River Plate.
Well, that might well be true, yes. You were completely shattered the time you came back from a raid, normally. But even so, we came back to bacon and eggs, we came back to a bed. And we knew that our fighting for that day was finished. An infantryman didn't. I mean, he might have been in a battle all day long today. He might get into his trench or whatever it was, or his foxhole, and suddenly find he's fighting within an hour again. So he never knew what was going to happen. And also from the little experience I've had of ground combat through watching the Russians and the Germans, it all seemed so disorganized. You didn't know who you were fighting, perhaps. At least I didn't understand who was fighting who and what they were doing. And I can well imagine that a soldier might be sitting there and saying, well, where are the enemy? Where are we supposed to be attacking? Are they behind us? But we knew exactly what we were doing, because we had one definite job, and it wasn't a fluid situation. You know, if you got into an attack by fighters, then you dealt with that. But you knew what you were up against. You knew when you got back to base that the trip was complete.
When you were on operations, did you dread going on them? Or did you even look forward to it?
Certainly didn't look forward to it, no. Say dread. I think you resigned yourself to it. You knew it was going to happen. And I think perhaps the worst time was when somebody said the battle order is out, and you rushed to look to see. And if you couldn't see your name on a battle order, you read it again and again and again. I've got to be on here. As I missed it, and then the sense of relief that you weren't on it. When you were on it, you know, it was like sort of being hit between the eyes, in a sense. It's happened again. And you then settled down to doing what you had to do. You were trained so that you had to prepare your charts for the night. I mean, you didn't sort of go around sort of, oh my God, I'm going to get killed tonight, or, you know, I'm all nervous and I can't write or anything like that. Occasionally you would get a person like that. You know, they'd go all quiet and morbid and moody, and you'd try and keep away from those people. But
because it was infectious.
Yes, it could be very infectious. But how can I explain it? You had to follow a procedure, and you were able to use this as a protection against thinking too much about what was going to happen.
Were there places that you particularly wished that you didn't have to go to in Germany? Or were they all the same?
Oh, they weren't all the same, no. Some targets were particularly nasty. The Ruhr Valley was particularly bad. I wasn't too keen on Frankfurt, I must admit. Essen was another really nasty one. Berlin, at first we were quite nervous about because of the length of the trip, but it turned out to be one of the less harrowing experiences.
Why?
This I can't explain, but the target didn't seem to be so active as, say, Essen, for example. Which does bring me to a little story about Essen. In my logbook, I've got an entry for Essen with 622 Squadron. And we were told that Krupp's Works had just been rebuilt after the last raid, and it had been months since Essen had been raided. And the story, how true it was or not, I don't know, but we were told by the intelligence people that just about now, which is 5 o'clock, they'd be signing the contract to hand back to the workers so they can continue production. and you're going over there at 7 or 8 tonight to wreck the place again. So well, wonder what it's going to be like. Because our more experienced people had told us that the Essen was one of the real nasty places to go to, you know, very heavily defended. So anyway, we ran again towards Essen. Oh, where's all the activity then? There's a bit of a cloud cover, and we could see a few shells bursting. Went in, dropped our bombs, and came home. And it was just like a, what should we say, a cross-country training flight, with just a few shells thrown in. And I don't mean to be funny by saying that. You know, the shells were way down, and they seemed to be no threat to us at all. Then we went to Pathfinder School, and then we went on, we were told, a training trip. So we said, well, where are we going on this training trip? He said, well, you'll find out at briefing. But surely you can tell us if we're going on a training trip. And nobody would tell us where we were going, so we went along to the briefing room at the appointed time. And there was a policeman at the door, and we said, well, what's going on? This is an operational briefing. So he said, yes. Well, I don't think we should be here. So he said, what's your name? Yes, you're here, but we're on a training trip. This is an operational trip. Well, he said, I'm afraid you can't go out again. You've got to go in. So we went up to the briefing officer, and we said, it'd been a dreadful mistake. You know, we're on a training trip. We've just arrived on the squadron. Oh, he said, your name's on the list. He said, this is an operational flight. He said, no training about this. He said, it's training for you as a Pathfinder. But sit down and start working. So anyway, initially it would be the pilot, the bomb aimer, and the navigator would do the specialist briefing first, and then the other crew members would come in later. And eventually the crew came in. They said, where are we going? I said, Essen. Oh, thank God for that, you know, that was no trouble at all. So you know, people sort of looking at us, what are these crews so jubilant about? Well, then we were told about a diversion raid that was going to take place near Essen. Of course, they'd send a few bombers to stir something up to divert the fighters and what have you. And we were heading down towards the target, and I was doing a time-wasting leg at the time, and the skipper said, what's all this out here? So I looked out. I said, oh my God, I said, that's dreadful. I said, that's the diversion target. Is it? I just don't expect many people to come out of that. Shouldn't think so, you know, because the activity was so violent. So, right, nothing to do with us, you know, I'll get back to my own business. And I sorted out my timing, got back on the track, and then gave an old direction heading, of course, towards the target. So he said, just a minute. He said, you're taking a serious diversion raid. I thought, oh my God, no, that's no diversion raid, that is us. That's our target. And as I remember the target, there's a big funnel of darkness leading up to the target. Outside that were masses of searchlights. At the end of this tunnel, there was a solid wall of searchlights and flak firing at all heights. And I thought, well, we've got to go through that. We'd never get through it. You know, this is just impossible. And I have, you know, put this into words. I've written all this out, but the my duty during the bombing run was to note the heading, the time, the bombs were dropped, the speed, and anything like that. And I thought, this is going to be a waste of time because nobody will ever read this. We'll never get through there at all. And obviously all this wall of fire is right on the aiming point. Anyway, I heard the bomb aimer say, bomb's gone, and any minute now we're going to get, you know, blown to pieces. And I thought, well, do I carry on with the log or not? You know, I was that convinced. So I thought, well, yes, I've got to, you know, just to keep my mind occupied. And then I heard bomb doors closed. Funny, well, I've got to look at it now, because at that instant I really had nothing to do. I looked out the window and the target was behind us. No, we got through, I just don't know. But that was one which really stood out in my mind.
Now, coming on to the Pathfinders, you've already explained how you were recruited to them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how you were introduced to Pathfinder techniques?
Yes, we first went to War Boys, which was a night fighter, Pathfinder school. And we were sort of given lectures on the subject. Our navigation was refined. We were taught to use H2S and such things as that. And it was the importance of timing was stressed, you know, most emphatically, that your timing must be accurate. And if I remember correctly, we were allowed something like 15 seconds either side of a dropping time. We were also taught that when we were doing a marking trip, that we would have to make a steady run for a minute and a half. And by a steady run, that meant that we were not to be disturbed by flak bursts, other aircraft, slipstreams, or anything like that. Providing we got that minute and a half dead steady run in, then we could drop our flares. Otherwise you'd drop bombs instead, because you used to carry flares and bombs, you know, in case this happened. Then after the six successful marking trips, six marking trips, then you were allowed to qualify as a Pathfinder, but not until then. You were a trainee Pathfinder until then. So before you were allowed to do the marking trips, you did training trips. This Essen was one example of our training trip, you see. So I forget exactly how many we did before we were allowed to carry flares, but we eventually qualified to become Pathfinders and to wear the badge. All we had to do was take the test next day, and we knew all the answers to that already, and we got shot down that night. So that was the end of that.
How proud were you to be a Pathfinder?
Very. Oh yes, very. Because, you know, I mean, it's without sounding snobbish, it was a select group. You know, you were specialists. And it's nice to be considered to be a specialist.
Did you actually meet Bennett during the war?
Yes, he came down and he gave us a pep talk on timing and, you know, absolute necessity to do steady bombing runs and things like this. In fact, he put his mark on us, you know, I am the boss, and that was what he came down to say.
In what effect, kind of impression did he make on you?
Very determined man. A dedicated man as well. Because I met him again later on during the airlift. And he was still just as dedicated then as he had been before.
Can you tell me about the raid in which you were shot down then?
Yes, that was on night of June the 15th, 16th, we were going to a marshalling yard in Lens on the Belgian border, which was one of the smaller raids, because after the major 1,000 bomber raids and building up to the invasion, and just after the invasion, we were doing small raids of 150 or so aircraft. And we go to a marshalling yard, the swamp in the marshalling yard. Another time we went to an airfield purely to bomb a building which Boffins were working in. But on this particular night, I found out later that the marshalling yard contained a lot of V1s which were being ready, made ready to move up to be fired against England. We dropped our bombs, or we'd been called down to a lower level by the master bomber, because under this 150 bomber raid you would have a master bomber who actually flew round around the target and directed excuse me, directed another aircraft on which flares to aim for, because he put the flares down on the roof of a building, or he may have put them down some on the ground. Ignore those on the ground, hit those on the roof, you know, this sort of thing, you see. And he called us down from 10,000 feet, I think it was the first, and we'd come down to 8,000 or 6,000, dropped our bombs, and we were on our way home when suddenly there was a great big bang and we dropped out of the sky. And I knew then that we'd been shot down.
I was.
We thought it was anti-aircraft fire. But almost immediately after this happened, a fighter closed in on us and started firing. And the gunner had called up to the skipper, you know, Corkscrew Port. And we started to go down to port. Well, we'd already dropped, you know, when the first explosion had happened. Then the... That's why we were called to Corkscrew. And the gunner called out, he said, climb starboard, or whichever opposite direction we had to go. The skipper said, I can't climb. Dig down again. And all the time he was firing. Then the mid-upper gunner called up and said, we're on fire. So the rear gunner said, yes, I think we better bail out. So I thought, this is impossible. Can't happen to us. And I got up on the Astrodome and I looked, and oh my God, yes. You know, it seemed to me that both wings were on fire. Whether they were or not, I don't know. Then the skipper said, right, Ron, feather the starboard outer. And Ron was an engineer who'd been dropping the bombs then, because Pathfinder engineers used to drop the bombs. He came back to feather the engine, and the skipper knocked his hand down. He said, don't worry, get out. Everybody out. And I thought, we're getting pretty close to the ground. And I looked at the airspeed indicator. It was 310, 320 knots. I don't know precisely what it was. And I started to move forward, and I forgot I hadn't unplugged my intercom lead. So I grabbed hold of my helmet to take it off, but it was a new type of helmet to me, and the lead came in from the back instead of from round the front, and I couldn't get the helmet off. It was all tangled up, and there I was tied to my desk with my intercom. So I had to go back and actually unplug it. And then by the time I got to the hatch, I thought, well, this is a waste of time, you know, I'm going to get cut off in the middle when we hit the ground. So what I tried to do then was to get past the rest of the crew, who were there were just two of them waiting to go out of the hatch. The hatch had jammed. That was another thing. Yes, the engineer was kicking the hatch, and I thought, I'm going to get past him and get up on the nose so I can get squashed quickly, you know, and then I don't get injured.